The Veritas Radio Network and the Crusade Channel present Kurt Wallace's The Flow. Real interviews with real people revealing real truths. Heard exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade Channel and available online at veritasradionetwork.com. Radio, the way it should be.
Presented by Veritas Radio Network's Crusade Channel, I'm Kurt Wallace, and this is The Flow. Our guest today is Charles Goyette, libertarian commentator, talk show host, and best-selling author of The Dollar Meltdown. He sits down with me to discuss his life from working with General Daniel Graham on national security policy, specifically addressing mutual assured destruction known as MAD, to promote Reagan's Star Wars defense program. He shares what happened that gave him the libertarian aha moment. He also delves into his deep study of the philosophy of Carl Jung and shares his personal experience with flow through art. He explains why he recently wrote a screenplay about Edgar Cayce, and he reveals a bit of his own spirituality. This is an interview you won't hear anywhere else. And Charles, thanks for spending time with us today on The Flow.
Kurt, it's always great to speak with you.
Well, you know, I was contemplating how we might have this conversation. There's a lot that we can cover in terms of things that you and I have talked about in the past, but have never really gotten into some of the real details of it. And there's also your history. I don't know how you became a libertarian. There's things about your dad that I think is very compelling. But before we talk about your experiences and get into an introspective aspect of that, you know, this show is called The Flow, and we were talking before the show began, and you knew where the name came from, that it came from the positive psychologist who wrote many books on flow, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, because you've read one of his books in the
past. I actually read Flow. It was a very long time ago, I suspect, when it first came out, and I don't remember a lot about it. I do remember he had a keen appreciation of Carl Jung, who has been a favorite of mine all of my life. I studied Jung intensely in college, not as part of a curriculum, not in classes. And when I was in college, the psychology curriculum consisted primarily of the study of chickens and white rats and flatworms and things like that. So it was a lot of animal behavioralism and didn't have a lot of room for the creative human spirit. And so I avoided academic psychology back in that day, much as I have avoided what passed for economics in that day. I avoided academic economics because it was all, you know, statistical aggregates of, you know, collective human behavior and stuff, and didn't appeal to me at all. But I had made a deep study of Carl Jung. I had actually show you how deep I was into it. I had two complete sets of his collective works, and I don't ask why I would need two complete sets. But I ripped through one, and I could have read the same one again, but somebody offered me their set at a discount price, and I thought, whoa, I've got to have that. So. So anyway, but flow appealed to me in that sense, and I can tell you is the best example, I suppose, that would resonate with people is that as an amateur painter, on and off over the years, I haven't done any lately, but three or four times in my life, I've tried my hand at it. But you know that experience, you know intuitively what the word flow even means when you hear it with respect to the creative process, because there I am working away on a seascape set in the Monterey Bay, and I start, and maybe it's 6 o'clock in the evening when I start on it, and the next time I look around, it's 4 a.m, and I've got to go to work in the morning.
That's so, it. You're
but you know, you're so completely absorbed in the creative process. You feel like a tool of something, you know, some aspect of yourself, perhaps that is higher than your daily comprehension or competency. And you know that's what it means by flow. And I can tell you, having spent a good deal of the last decade or so in writing, that I know after slaving away at the keyboard for a couple of hours, and maybe it's difficult to get going and stuff, but you reach a point, you hit a breakthrough where You're struggling for your fingers to keep up with as fast as the ideas come. And then when you look back at what you have done, you have to look at it with a certain, if you're in that moment, you look at it with a certain degree of awe. And I'm not saying that every time or every creative person that has that experience has done remarkable, wonderful, world-class work. But I'm saying you look back at it and you think, that's better than I could do. That's better than I am. That's written beyond my skill level. And then you know that you've been in the process that that we call flow.
And this is something that just happens. It's not something you can manufacture.
Right.
It's a real state. It's a meditative state, I guess.
Well, you have to open yourself up to it, but it doesn't happen if you resist it.
Sure.
And so you have to open yourself up. And, you know, I suppose I know that with respect to painting, for example, I know where you really find that experience. And I love acrylics, and I paint when I paint, which is rarely, but I paint in acrylics. But I actually know from the little dabbling I've done in my life that you really experience that state when you paint with watercolors. In fact, isn't flow kind of a liquid, a fluid word? You have to be open to the accidents and the spontaneity of what takes place with the presence of water and moisture and stuff on the canvas and things going where they will of their own. And you work with that process rather than resisting it or being determined that it shall be this way and ordering everything in your mind prior. You work with the flow of the moment.
Yeah, yeah, and in this state that which I've experienced a lot in my life, and I experience it in different ways. What happens is we lose ourselves in a way. We lose the ego or the idea of persona, like the mask. The idea, the Greek word for persona is mask, and that disappears, and time doesn't exist. This is something that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi says that. Is when people are genuinely happy because they're not tied and attached to things that really are a hindrance to this particular state. Carl Jung also talked about how to alleviate or contain feelings of trauma and fear and anxiety, and also even to restore and heal and repair through this kind of experience of doing art therapy.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and you probably know way more about Jung than I could imagine, but there is a significant tie there between Csikszentmihalyi and Carl Jung in the fact that when Mihaly was a young man, he was broke, had nothing to do one evening, and he saw that there was going to be a talk given at a university about UFO phenomenons after World War II, and he went to hear this psychologist talk, and it was Carl Jung, and he was talking about the illusion of seeing UFOs and why people with PTSD were experiencing this kind of a phenomenon, this increase in that, and Mihaly decided he wanted to do what he did, and it was it was directly inspired by Carl Jung, but I guess you might have.
Well, I know that aspect of Jung's work pretty well. He wrote actually a volume about it, and he treated it. And he was very Jung was always very protective of his academic impartiality or his academic credentials and reputation. So he never explicitly disclaimed any comment about whether UFOs are real or not real, but he wanted to talk about it as a psychological phenomena. You know, it's kind of the myth of our age. Sure. And you know, the transcendent or the extra normal appears to people in different ages in different manifestations. I mean, you only go back 250 years and you find people in Ireland that see fairies in the woods, right?
Sure.
So he wrote about it as a psychological phenomenon. He wrote about the typical shape of the UFO as kind of a mandala, mandala symbol. And so without regard to what their reality or not their reality, because so many people talked about them, so many people claimed to have had sightings or experiences, he thought it was an important psychological phenomena for him to delve into. And he did so. He did so brilliantly. But with regard to your point about the use of art in therapy, he often did that. He would often have people hand people a sketchboard and inks or paints and ask them to, you know, represent their dreams or construct mandala symbols as a symbol of you know, the shape of the totality of the human psyche, and not just the persona, as you pointed out earlier, not just, you know, not just the ego, but the whole totality of the human psyche. And Jung was very good at this. I think of him as sort of a Magellan in his exploration, just as the Magellans and Vasco da Gama's and these other explorers, you know, mapped out the world, sailed and mapped out the complete sphere of the earth. Jung was a great discoverer or explorer of the human unconscious, the unconscious aspect of the human mind, and mapped a great deal out of it. And we use terms that come from Jung all the time. We talk about, you know, the shadow or the anima or the animus, the kind of the female side, for example, of male consciousness, or the male side of female consciousness, and so on. We use all of these terms. We use terms like introvert and extrovert, and these are all Jungian terms. And he didn't mean, when he talked about an extrovert, he didn't mean somebody that was socially gregarious like you are, Kurt, you know, that, you know, gets along with people and makes friends real fast. He meant somebody whose reality basis is based on, you know, on their interaction with the external world, whereas an introvert finds their reality, you know, in the basis of their internal consciousness and so on and so forth. So all of these things are attributed to him, but the use of painting in therapy and mandala symbolism and stuff in Jung is very, very rich work.
You know, another quick thing about him, and I definitely want to get into your story, but this is so interesting to me that you're talking about these things. One other thing that happened in history that has been a game changer in the world, it has to, because of the amount of people that have gone on a journey of recovery from alcoholism and even drug addiction, is that Carl Jung sparked what ended up becoming Alcoholics Anonymous through a relationship with an American businessman who could not stop drinking, named Roland Hazard, and was doing everything he could, and went to Europe. And Jung basically had a conversation with him, a come to Jesus moment, so to speak, and said, there's nothing I can do to help you, and you're hopeless, and you have to have some sort of a spiritual experience. And he even went on later to describe something that he wrote, which is to the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is about spiritus contra spiritum. And it's a Latin phrase, that alcohol counters spiritualism.
Mm-hmm.
He had such a deep understanding of cause and effect within the human experience, which is profound to me that somebody had that type of insight.
Well, you know, the human psyche can only be experienced in one place, and this is the problem with much of the recent trends in the last, I'll even venture to say 100 years or more, trends in the psycho or social sciences, is that they have tried to ape the physical sciences. They have tried to emulate, to copy the you know, the laboratory sciences of guys in white coats and stuff. And this is all understandable to me, because the physical sciences have accomplished so much, and they have transformed our lives in so many ways. Their contributions to modern life are wonderful, but they deal with things like quantity, and they are not capable. They deal with things that can be weighed and measured. That's the nature of the physical sciences. The human psyche cannot be weighed, it cannot be measured, it cannot be quantified. But they aped the psycho and social sciences, tried to ape the physical sciences, and, you know, turn everything into something measurable. That's how psychology actually descended into what I described during my student years about the measurement of response of chickens and flatworms, instead of the richness of the human psyche, right?
Sure.
The creative richness of the psyche, the autodynamic self-balancing functions of the psyche, the compensating features of the human psyche, the dynamic of the human psyche to strive for health health and wholeness, all of these. And none of these things can be weighed. None of these things can be measured. It's like, you know, asking you, Kurt, to tell me how many pounds do you love your kids? You know, it's not susceptible to that kind of thing. Well, so where is the human psyche experienced? If you can't experience the human psyche and study it in the behavior of flatworms and rats, mm-hmm. and chickens, you can only experience it in your own consciousness. Mm. And Jung was fearless about what the Greeks called the axiom of the Greeks, to know thyself. So he was fearless in investigating the human psyche within himself, so that he could apply his discoveries to his field of analytical psychology.
So in your experience growing up, your dad was a professor of philosophy. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that where you got all of the inspiration to explore this human nature?
Well, it sure didn't hurt.
Yeah. But, I mean, do you remember conversations with your father when you were a kid?
Oh, sure. But you know, I'm one of six kids and,
Wow.
And the other kids all had different interests. And so, and having been a parent myself, I think that, you know, it's clear to me that, that kids bring something into the world with them. I mean, they are who they are in so many ways, yeah, without regard to nurture. They come in with something, with propensities and predilections and so on. They come in with something. So I came in with something that would resonate with that sort of interest. One of my brothers is took his graduate degree in mathematics, and my dad, as a philosophy professor, also could easily have been a university level professor of mathematics. That aspect of what he did was of no interest to me. So you bring who you are in to your environment, into your culture, and into your family life. And I'm certainly glad that there were a lot of things that we had in common, but we kind of are who we are. And the things that resonate with our heart find a way to make their way out, no matter what environment you're found in.
So, in growing up in a family, this is a large family you had.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And growing up in that, where were you in the sibling age?
Yeah, I was. There are three boys in a row, and then three girls. So I was the third boy. So it's kind of in the middle of the pecking order. So I had two older brothers, yeah, and three younger sisters.
Ah, okay. And so you were going through the experience of being the youngest boy, but then also then you had three girls. What an interesting thing for your parents to have three boys in a row, then three girls in a row.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of funny, because then my older brother got married and started having kids, and bam, three boys in a row. And then the next one was a girl, and then this duplicated itself with my next brother. Bam, he had a son, and then bang, twin boys, and they stopped there.
Yeah.
So, and I have two boys, and I stopped there. So, yeah. You know, I don't know how that happened that way, but it was, you know, it was great for somebody with kind of libertarian instincts like me, because, you know, by the time, I mean, you know how parents are with the firstborn, you know, they drop the pacifier on the floor and the parents run to boil it and sterilize it and so on. And by the third kid, you know, they're a lot more,
yeah, sure,
you know, detached and free and loose and breezy about stuff. They're not quite. And then having three girls follow me, you know, I think that that demanded a lot of their attention and left me free to explore my wild and unruly ways.
Were you a wild kid then, or did you get into trouble?
Well, I'd have to say yes, Kurt, to tell you the truth.
me too.
You know, I wasn't a bad kid. I didn't do things that were destructive, but seemed like I was pretty insistent from a pretty young age of setting my own hours and being pretty free and doing things that, I mean, I would never have dreamed of allowing my boys to do when they were growing up. You know, just a degree of freedom and I won't say irresponsibility, but just kind of a degree of, you know, autonomy in the way I lived and what I did that today we'd all be a little shocked by, I think.
Do you think that had something to do with the fact that who you are as a person? Were you very different from your brothers in that respect?
Yeah, no
question.
They
were party line. This is what you do. These are the boxes that you go into.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what you check off, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so. It harkens back to what we were saying earlier, that you bring who you are into the world. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, this is enormously frustrating for, you know, the material reductionists and the biological reductionists that say, you know, everything's, you know, for the B.F. Skinners of the world, that everything is taught and everything's nurture and behavioralism and so on and so forth. But, you know, each of my siblings, you know, had their own intentions and their own ideological diversions from the perfect childhood. You know, they all had the ways they wanted to be. Yeah. And mine, I think, was, you know, to be a little bit more free-spirited than the other kids. So, okay. And that has stuck with me all my life. I've tried to make sure that I've tamed it so that it's a feature of my life and not a master of my life. I've tried to keep it, you know, make sure that, you know, it's subordinated to my awareness, my consciousness, and my intention, but I still basically have the same sort of orientation.
What's interesting to me in your experience too, is that you served in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of interested in exploring, where you were and where you went in terms of your perspective on military, the use of,
sure,
of a national defense or, mm-hmm, and that sort of thing. 'Cause you've been involved with in circles that I believe, if I'm not mistaken in my research, there was a group of speakers that, spoke in behalf of the Reagan, Star Wars,
yeah,
program and,
yeah,
and those sorts,
well,
of things.
So, yeah, I can tell you about that. I was an enlisted man in the service, and I had been a broadcaster as a teenager, a commercial broadcaster and a radio personality. And so when I went in the service, I auditioned for and was accepted in Armed Forces Radio and TV. And I anchored the news on one of the television networks and did a talk show on one of the television networks, and then shifted over and did a radio program for the network where I was stationed. But I had a deep interest in, this was during the Vietnam War years. I had a deep interest in foreign policy and the military policy and so on. So just to make a quick story out of that, not to bore anybody, but sometime before Reagan was elected president, I met Danny Graham, General Daniel Graham. He'd been the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't he the deputy director?
He was deputy director of the CIA. Right. It's been so long since I've talked about this, but he had been an advisor to Reagan, I think, as far back as 76. Mm-hmm. And he shared the concern. I should say, I put it the other way around. It inflates me more than I deserve by all means. But I shared the concern that he had and a few other thoughtful people had about the prevailing defense policy in this country, which was mutual assured destruction. It was basically that the American people would have no defense against the biggest threat that really mankind has ever faced. They're, you know, thousands, 10,000 Soviet warheads pointed at the United States, and we had virtually no defense against them. Mm. It was a standoff. This was the defense policy of the United States, was a standoff. And so the Soviets could be moderately convinced that we won't attack them because we know that if we attack them, if we launch first launch against the Soviets, they will retaliate and we'll all die and they'll all die and everybody will be happy. Mm-hmm. And it is a policy. The acronym Mutual Assured Destruction is really perfect because it was virtually, it was absolutely insane. But, and I'll tell you one of the real peculiarities, most people don't understand this. While incineration by Soviet nuclear weapons was a good enough defense policy for the American people, they carved out the political classes in Washington, carved out an exemption from the anti-ballistic missile treaty for themselves. Mm-hmm. So that while the rest of the country, we were innocent, we didn't do anything, we didn't negotiate any deals, we weren't bellicose, we weren't, you know, causing wars and invading countries or anything, you know, so why shouldn't we be defended? But no, they carved out an exemption in the ABM treaty that the Capitol, that the White House could be defended. So they could put up a missile defense around the White House to protect the president, mm-hmm, but it wasn't good enough for the rest of the people. And by the same token, the Soviets, I mean, it's, you know, politicians around the world are the same thing. So they had forsworn defending their people in the ABM treaty, but they were allowed an exemption that they could defend the Kremlin. Mm. You know, it's simply insane. Anyway, General Graham was opposed to that idea before Reagan became president. Reagan finally picked up on the idea of changing the defense policy to one of an affirmative defense. And it worked out very well. All the skeptics said, you can't ever do this. It's technologically impossible. Well, some of the technological challenges that we thought were difficult back in the Reagan years are almost child's play now.
Sure.
But in any event, it became a policy that had a huge impact on the Cold War. And though it wasn't deployed in its entirety in the way that it could have been, the policy had a great deal to do with the breakup of the Soviet Union. I mean, they looked at it and they said, well, we can't compete on this technological basis. We can't compete with the United States. And so it was one of the factors that ended breaking down the evil empire of the Soviets. So, yeah, I was on the National Speakers Bureau of High Frontier. That was the civilian organization that lobbied for a defense policy actually designed to defend the American people and break the Cold War stalemate, the terror by nuclear death stalemate that the political classes has gotten this country into.
We're going to have to take a short break. You're listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace, our special guest, Charles Goyette.